offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. We are back after a short break. Hope you all enjoyed the wonderful birthday celebrations. As always, we had the privilege of broadcasting whatever happened here to all of you through our live broadcast, audio and video. It is always a pleasure to be able to share what happens here, the most joyous celebrations, with all of you. And after that short break, we are back here to continue. And it's time for the Conversations with Sai, the book authored by Dr. Hislop, which were transcripts of conversations that he has had over an extended period of time with Swami. We are in the middle of that. The last week around, we were in the middle of a discussion which actually meandered through many important topics about spirituality. As we've seen in the past couple of episodes, most often this is an interview where it's an assorted number, assorted group which is there, people who are Indian, foreign and newcomers, and all of them together. Swami is giving them all the opportunity to ask questions, sometimes even participate in the discussion. Some people try to pitch in and try to explain further what Swami is saying, and we've seen sometimes it is a little off too, the explanation I mean, of their understanding of what Swami is saying. But we see that sometimes Swami's answers are very, very specific. You can make out that they are targeted at something which Hislop is asking based on his understanding. And last time around, there was one particular statement which Swami had made. Probably we'll just read up that again and we'll progress. Because Swami had summarized in one or two sentences what is the best path towards God in the modern context, where Hislop had asked, of the many roads to self-realization, what is the shortcut? Of course, the word shortcut is used in a different context where you kind of suggest a certain amount of laziness of the person who is embarking on the journey. But nevertheless, it also shows a restlessness to reach the destination as soon as one can. And the answer that Swami gave to that question is one that describes what is the best approach to self-realization in the modern context, in the context of the modern lifestyle that we are all leading. So Swami says in response, the shortcut is this way. The name of God is the seed. Love is the water by which the crop grows. Discipline is the fence which protects the growing crop. The field in which the crop is grown is the spiritual heart. The crop, when it comes to harvest, is bliss. And it was with that answer and a little bit of our reflections on that particular answer, we concluded the 12th episode last time around. We are here to proceed from that point. But before we read the passages which are meant for discussion today, let's invite Arvind, as always, to join all of us. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem. And as always, it's a great pleasure and privilege to be part of this wonderful series where we are having a virtual conversation with Bhagwan, because these are his words, and his words have multiple dimensions, multiple perspectives based on the situation in our life, based on our own Deshakala Paristhiti. We get different meanings, we understand different things, and that is also the reason why we invite our listeners as well to contribute their thoughts. You want to be a part of the Afternoon Satsang, you too can, by just doing your homework as we do. Please read up the conversations with Sai, and any thoughts you get, you can share with us via email, and we will definitely incorporate them, because as I said, every word from Bhagwan, every analogy that he gives, every example that he so beautifully demonstrates, it carries multiple meanings, and what meanings, the frequency with which we resonate depends on the frequency to which we are tuned in, and we are nobody to judge which is a lower frequency or a higher frequency, but we definitely will agree to this much, that all of us are different frequencies, and it is definitely the compassion of Kali Yuga avatar, our beloved Bhagwan, that he broadcast at such a broad bandwidth so that all people of all frequencies could tune in and gain some benefit and progress in their own lives. So we continue with the conversation where Hislop is now asking, why should one attempt to gain self-realization when one is always self-realized? This is a very understandable question, and a question that even many of us will get in our minds when we first hear Bhagwan saying that all of you are embodiments of divine. Divyatma Swarupulara, Prema Swarupulara, that is how he addresses us. He tells us that I am God, but so are you. The only difference is I know it and you don't know it. And the thought that comes in my mind after I hear that statement is, Swami, now that you have told it to me, I also know it. But still, I don't think that I am God. Why is this difference coming? You say that you know you are God, I don't know I am God. But now that I know theoretically that I am God, I am still not able to experience that. Why is this disconnect? The same question, I think, in different words, is what Hislop is asking. Why should one attempt to gain self-realization when one is always self-realized? The answer that Swami gives, again, is a short one in one statement. Swami says, as of now, there is a mixture of the mind of sensory identification. As of now, there is a mixture in the mind of sensory identification. The mind is not fully one-pointed. So what Swami says is simple. He says that one part of your mind, one thought in the mind, because Swami says that the mind is a cloth which is made up of multiple threads, with each thread being a thought. So Swami says that among those multiple threads, one thread or one thought is possibly this, that I am God, I am divine. But then, as Swami says here, there is a mixture, because along with that thread, there are so many other threads as well. And therefore, there is a need to have attempts and efforts made to gain self-realization, because the mind is not fully one-pointed. It is not having a single thought. There are multiple thoughts that come and dilute this thought that I am divine. And that is the reason that efforts need to be made.
This is, as you said, is a question which always would occur to us. In fact, when we were doing the Ramakatha Satsang, we were speaking about the kind of drama that Lord Rama plays when he goes around listening to the discourses of Advaitins. Mm. And he pretends as though he has no interest in the duties that attach themselves to him as a prince, as a son, as a member of the family. Where traditionally in the Valmiki Ramayana is spoken of Rama being destabilized by the concepts of Advaita, where it is said that nobody belongs to anybody, nobody is related to anybody, Everybody is divine. And we spoke of how that episode is there in the Ramayana to suggest that when you are not initiated into the right kind of thinking, that becomes like an unsettling thought that you are divine. And you, as I think in another discourse, Swami very beautifully says that as long as you've not sublimated the ego, when given this thought that you are divine, the ego jumps at it and claims that it is God. And he says that will lead to even more problems than, we know what kind of confusion that can cause if one were to think that I am divine. And so Swami is saying that the sublimation of ego has to be there. Only then this idea of you are divine can be truly understood. But Swami says that is what it is. The impurities in the mind is what makes that idea not complete in that sense. And the next question that Hislop is going to ask is going to be based on that. But of course, before that, you want to add something?
Yes. I just wanted to add one small thing that when we say that the mind is not fully one-pointed or the ego has not been fully sublimated, it is not like... It's not possibly like I'm a very bad person or doing dirty things or nothing like that. It is just that ego is such a subtle thing. It happens so unconsciously at times that we don't even realize we are under the influence of ego. I often would like to think of it like when I'm playing a video game. I have a character in the video game. Possibly that character is searching for a treasure, or that character is driving a car in a race, or depending on whether my video game is an adventure game or whatever, there are characters and I identify myself with a character. Now, I'm fully aware that it's just a game, that's only virtual, that irrespective of what happens in the game, nothing in my life changes. Theoretically, I'm actually well grounded in that truth. But still, things that happen in the game change my real life. They affect my moods. We have seen that happening. for those of our listeners who are possibly not interested in video games, you can take the example of a movie. We know that everything is false there, but yet when we watch it, there are tears that flow down our eyes, there is laughter that comes from our heart, everything happens. Which means that even something false, something which is virtual, has the ability to create something which is real for us, make us feel that it is real, even if it's for a short time. In a way, that is what it is. You know, that is what is illusion or maya, or that is what is causing ego. You know, ego is wrong identification of oneself, where I identify myself with my body and mind rather than with the atma that I truly am. Which means that it's not that if I am only proud or angry or jealous or falling a victim to lust and greed that I am being egoistic. Even when I am completely enjoying something, you know, some food that I like to eat, or I like ice cream, for example. I enjoy the ice cream and then I say, hey, this is lovely, I want two more, I want three more. When I eat more, even there actually I am indulging in my ego. Because if I am thinking that I am enjoying this, it is actually the body that is enjoying, the tongue that is enjoying. And in order for me to feel that I am enjoying it, I am identifying myself with the body. So when we say that we have to sublimate the ego, and when we say that we are being egoistic, it's not like we are monsters. Ego is so subtle that in our day-to-day life, when we undergo pain or when we undergo pleasure, both the times it's not us undergoing it, it's the body or mind undergoing it. And when I feel that I am undergoing it, that shows ego. No wonder that multiple times Swami has defined perfect faith or perfect devotion or the best devotee as he who is equanimous in the face of pleasure and pain. Because it is only when you're equanimous in the face of pleasure and pain can you be close to sublimating the ego. The moment we are affected by the pleasure or by the pain, it shows that we are in the clutches of ego.
When Swami says here that the mind is not fully one-pointed, so I think the suggestion probably we can draw from that is Swami saying that there are moments when you can feel that, you know, you don't need any distance to travel. You don't need to get somewhere. You don't have to become something because you're already that. Reminded of a talk which I had heard. This was about a sadhu from the Ramakrishna Math, and who was very, very well versed in some yogic practices and meditation and all that. And I don't know exactly what was the problem, but he had some condition which required a surgery in his finger or his hand. So the doctors examined it and said, you know, Swamiji, it's a very small surgery that needs to be done. And, you know, we don't even have to completely put you down in that sense. You know, just a local anesthesia is good enough. And just a hour's procedure, I think you should be fine. So this Swamiji, you know, who had really attained that state where he can withdraw himself completely from the body, he said, I don't need any anesthesia. You can come tomorrow and you can perform the surgery. And to the amazement of all the doctors and the staff who had come, without any anesthesia, he kind of gave his hand, he was completely awake, and they did the surgery, which is actually pretty deep in the skin in that sense, you know, quite painful. And there was not even a twitch in his expressions, there was absolutely no sign. You know, some of us can bear with pain, but he was not even feeling pain. He literally was in such a state where the entire surgery was done. The doctor bandages him and, you know, and leaves. Apparently, the next day when the doctor comes to just check whether the wound is healing, the Swamiji is asleep. So he very casually lifts the hand and he starts checking. And the Swamiji wakes up with a huge scream and says, oh, what are you doing? It hurts so badly. And then the doctor said, but Swamiji, what I did yesterday was 100 times more painful than me just trying to open the bandage and see your wound. And then the Swamiji said, but I was not prepared. Right? Had you told me that you're going to do this, then I would have been prepared to remove myself from the body. So when Swami says that, you know, it is a state which is available, right? There are some practices, there are some meditations and techniques by which we can even now, if we want, touch that. You know, that few moments of samadhi could be attained. But the very fact that we are still not there completely all the time is because, as Swami says, that your one-pointedness of the mind in that state is not absolute. It is still subjective to so many other things.
I remember many times when Swami in the discourses would tell the word chit, and Professor Anil Kumar would translate it as awareness. Many times Swami would turn immediately to him, correct him, and say constant integrated awareness. So right. There is a reason why Swami would do that, because as you said, awareness possibly is a state that we reach now and then. We, with practice, with effort, we can. But constant and integrated, that constant integrated awareness is something that has to be achieved in order to actually say that I need not make any effort for self-realization, because I'm already in a state of constant integrated awareness. If I'm having awareness, it's not enough. If I'm having constant awareness, it's not enough. That awareness should be constant and integrated with the whole virtual world also. In the sense that just by me taking myself out, but still believing everything else to be real, also doesn't help. So that is the challenging thing. That is why Swami says that, that is the answer that Swami gives to Hislop asking, why should I then put effort for self-realization when I'm already self-realized? You don't have to put effort for actual self-realization, but you have to put in efforts to remain in that state of awareness. It's like, in science we study the concept of entropy. Entropy is a natural process by which everything goes towards disorderliness, maximum freedom. That is the reason why, in fact, death is considered as a form of entropy. Because everything moves towards decay, towards breaking away. You have to put in energy to hold it together. Therefore, to hold our body in this structure itself, there is a lot of energy and work going on. In fact, we say we are growing when the rate of growth of the bone is higher than the rate of degeneration of the bone. The rate of replenishment of our blood vessels, blood cells, is faster than the rate of decay of the same thing. As long as that is happening, we are growing. Then comes a point in time where the growth and the decay become equal. That is possibly the middle ages. We have become adults. And then it moves on to a stage where the rate of decay becomes faster than the rate of regeneration. That is when we say we are aging, dying starts. And finally, when the rate of deceleration becomes much more than the rate of production, that is what death happens. That is entropy. So therefore, when I say that I am doing nothing, in reality I am doing so much. That is the reason why though we eat 2000 calories of food on a daily basis on an average, just with 2000 calories we won't put on fat. Because all that is necessary just to maintain the body processes. It's only when we overeat we need to do exercises. But a prescribed amount of calories is just burnt because we are awake, our brain is classifying stuff, the food is being digested. All this involves so much energy. So therefore, in order to just sit without doing anything itself, so much energy is needed. In the same way, just to have that awareness itself, so much of effort is necessary. And therefore, when we say a yogi is sitting without doing anything, it is a wrong statement to make, because a true yogi is actually putting in tremendous effort and energy to remain in that state of awareness. That itself requires so much, so that you don't get drawn and you don't get pulled apart by the natural entropy that exists.
And this question that Hislop is asking, and of course the following few questions that he's going to ask, again shows his understanding. He is coming from a state of understanding where he has kind of gone through all of these things. Hmm. Because this is what Swami says, that he says that you don't become realized. You just be. And that's what he's asking. I'm already self-realized. According to Vedanta, that's what it is. That you cannot become God. You are God, and you actually start giving up not being God, if you could put it that way. And it reminds me of that famous Gita Shloka which Shirdi Baba explains to Nana, right? I think he explains it to Nana Sahib Chandolkar, where that Pranipata, he asks, why is it Pariprashna and not Prashna? The second part of that shloka where he explains, he says, the shloka goes, I have it here, it says, Te Jnanam Jnanina Tattva Darshina, which means when you do all these Pranipata, Pariprashna and Sevaya, then those who have seen the truth will teach you Jnana. That's what it is. But Shirdi Baba asks him the word actually used there is Te Jnanam. So Shirdi Baba asks him, how do you split that? So the devotee says, te and jnanam, which means they will give you knowledge. And Shirdi Baba says, instead of jnanam, if I put ajnanam there, will the words still remain the same? So te ajnanam is still te jnanam only.
When you combine
when it becomes sandhi, right? When you combine it. So he says, yeah, it's the same, Baba, but it doesn't make any sense. Why will those people who are realized give you ajnanam? And they should actually give you knowledge. Then Shirdi Baba explains this. See, what you are, you already know. Nobody can teach you who you are. Nobody can come and introduce you to you. But if you are mistaken about your identity, that can be pointed out to you. So what the guru gives you is actually knowledge about ajnanam. What you really are is already there. And Swami would say that it is like blowing out that ash which covers the embers. You are not making that thing glow, but you're only removing that which makes that embers be covered and not to be seen.
And for that effort is needed.
Right, and for that effort, and that is what Swami is going to be talking next.
And Swami continues, now Hislop continues actually. He says, now that Swami has told him that effort is needed, Hislop's next question is, Swami, time is needed for the plane to arrive in India, but why is time needed for self-realization? Is not an immediate awakening possible entirely apart from time? It's almost like effort is necessary, okay, but why does that effort take so long? Why can't it be done in a jiffy? Because time should not matter. And Swami replies, immediate awakening apart from time? Yes, it is possible. If the faith is full and perfect, then grace comes fully at that very moment, just as the sound and the bullet occur at the same moment. So Swami is saying, no, time doesn't matter at all. What matters is that effort. And if the faith is full and perfect, then instantly it happens. But what Swami leaves unsaid, I think, is possibly the fact that to get full faith and perfect faith, we need possibly lifetime or lifetimes of effort. So Swami is saying that once you have full and perfect faith, there is no need for time. There is no need for you to put that effort for long. Swami would often say that a room may be in darkness for thousands of years, but all it requires is one moment to put on the switch. But then I feel that if it's a dark room and I don't know where the switch is, we might have had this experience. We enter a new home or a new room, or when we go to a hotel or anywhere, unless somebody has already shown us the switch, we will actually grope around in the darkness to find the switch. Now, how long we will grope in the darkness to find the switch, that nobody can tell. 1 minute, 10 minutes, 100 hours. Once you find the switch and put it on, it's instantaneous. So, actually, if you ask me how long did it take for you to light the room, I may say it took me 20 minutes. Because 19 minutes, 59 seconds to find the switch, 1 second to turn it on. Correct. So, Swami is saying that once you have found the switch, then it takes only one moment. You don't need time at all. So like that, Swami is saying, once you have perfect faith, it's done. But I think, yeah, just like all the time goes in searching for that switch, all our effort and time goes in actually developing what Swami calls as perfect and full faith.
Absolutely. In fact, the question that Hislop is asking in that sense is, again, driving that same point of why should it take time to reveal something which is already in you? To go from one point A to point B, which is separated by space, you can talk of time being a necessity there. And Swami, in fact, in the first discussion which we had, Swami speaks of the four qualities of the manifest world: karma, kartavyam, and kala. And he says that you start from Delhi, you have to go to Bangalore, you need that time, you need to do that action in all of that. So he says, Swami, when you say that I am realized in my core, when you say that I am divinity already, why should it take time for me to get there? Shouldn't it be instantaneous? But nevertheless, if you look at it, what Swami is saying is, as you very beautifully said, that effort to get there. For instance, a child which is born, to really come to its, let's say a great musician is born as a small child in the next birth. Yes, the same talent is there in the child, but to get that talent out and for that to get expressed, it will take at least 14, 15 years till that child is in a state where it can go on a stage and perform or do something, where the talent gets completely expressed, though that knowledge
is latent
in that. So Swami is saying that exactly, if full faith is there, the moment that full faith comes, it happens instantaneously, like what you are saying, that it takes no time, no effort, no distance needs to be traveled. But to get there, that searching is a process, and that takes time.
In fact, I remember during the World Youth Conference in 2007, Swami made a very dramatic statement during his discourse, I think the valedictory discourse, and Swami said that you all keep doing sadhana, you do this, you want to see God, you want to attain perfection. You need not struggle at all. All you need is to direct your mind onto God and keep it away from all other distractions just for 11 seconds. Swami said, 11 seconds is enough. So that's all it is. But, you know, as we were discussing before, it is like saying that all you need to win the Olympic gold is just 9 seconds of running. That's all. 9 seconds is enough. But to reach a stage where I can run those 9 seconds in that manner, to reach a state where I can actually spend those 11 seconds thinking of God and only God and nothing else, I think that requires lifetime or lifetimes of effort.
Right. In fact, you know, in the primary school, there is this bhajan which is sung little differently. Hmm. Man ek bar hari bol. Apparently, they sing it as man bar bar hari bol.
Uh-huh. Right? Okay.
Right? So, the idea is, yes, if you call once, God will come. But to be able to call in that manner that God comes even once, you need lifetimes of taking God's name again and again and again. Till one day, actually, it takes only one call. Right? That is why the bhajan says, man ek bar hari bol. Once if you call, he will come. But to get that bhavam in that one call, you need so many bar bar hari bol you have to do for that one hari to come.
Absolutely. Going ahead with the same conversation, Hislop then says, but Swami, one believes that he does have full faith. Therefore, that must be self-deception then. Because Swami is saying here that if faith is full and perfect, grace comes instantly. And Hislop says that, but Swami, each one of us, we believe that we have full faith in you. So does it mean that that is self-deception? Because it is not full faith, evidently, from what you have said. Therefore, it must be self-deception. I don't have full faith. And Swami gives a beautiful answer. Swami says, as long as one thinks he has faith, he does not. Just as when one knows that he is meditating, he is not meditating. This we had discussed before, where Swami is saying that as long as you think that you are meditating, it's not meditation. Because when you are in meditation, you don't feel that you are meditating. You don't say that I meditated for 20 minutes or 1 hour. I think we also discussed a conversation where Swami is asking a person, how long do you meditate? And when he tells how much time, Swami says, that is not meditation. If you are in meditation, you won't even know. Days may pass, hours may pass. That's what it is. So Swami says that as long as you are thinking that you are having faith, it is not faith. Just like as long as you know you are meditating, you are not meditating. Only when meditation is automatic all day long, that is meditation. Full faith is reached by sadhana, just as Bombay is reached by approaching it.
Right. Again, this is, I think, something which Swami has told in the context of many, many spiritual concepts. As you said about meditation, where Swami says that only when you lose yourself, the explanation that Swami gives in the Anuvaini is when the one who meditates, the one that is meditated upon, and the process of meditation becomes one.
Mm.
In that sense, the one who is meditating, again, it goes back to that, I am doing this, that ego getting sublimated is at the crux of the whole thing. In fact, just talking about meditation, there's the same thing Swami tells even about loving God. I think we've narrated this incident many, many times. One of our old students, Mayur Pandya, he narrates this about the old bungalow days of Vrindavan. Apparently, there was this one particular window which used to open to Swami's stairs from upstairs. When Swami used to come walking down from his room, there was this window which was actually midway of that particular stairs. And all the children used to put their face on that window, because that is the time when you can get closest to Swami, really physically in that sense, because it's a narrow staircase. Even if Swami wants to move away from you, there is not much space to do that.
Mm.
And invariably, they would have beautiful interactions then. Swami would stop there and stare at them, make faces sometimes, or, you know, try to make them laugh. And some things, interactions used to be there. On one particular day, when he was at that window, with his face pressed against that window, trying to get that close glimpse of Swami, Swami stops on that stairs, looks at him and starts staring at him for a good few seconds.
Hmm.
And such moments, you never know. It could go either way. Swami might suddenly break into a smile and it could be a lighter moment. Or maybe Swami is pulling you up for something which you've done years ago. You never know. It could be anything. So, but nevertheless, it was a profound moment. So he was also staring back into Swami's eyes. And Swami kept looking at him for some time. And then suddenly Swami asked him, "Hey Mayur, do you love me?" And he said, "What a question to ask. Of course, Swami, why would I be craning my neck here and standing on that thing for so many hours to get this one glimpse?" Because he didn't say all this to Swami. He was thinking in his mind. He said, "Yes, Swami, of course I do." And Swami slowly drew back and he said, "No, no, no, no." Shook his head. And he was surprised. He said, "Swami, but I think I really love you." Then Swami explained the same concept what Swami is telling about meditation. Swami said, "If you truly love me, you will not even know that you love me." Which means the person who loves, the person who is loved and the process of loving all become one, you will not be able to tell that I love so and so. Right? So anything, and I mean, that again is a description of every path leading to God, I think. Whether you do it through meditation, you do it through karma. Again, when talking about service, I think last time when we were discussing that, we mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
When service becomes perfect when you're thinking that you're doing it to yourself, not to another person. Dhyana becomes perfect when the person who's meditating becomes one with that which is being meditated upon. Love becomes perfect when the one who's loving and the one who's loved is one and the same. So all paths should give that same experience. But depending on which angle you come from, I think it's going to be labeled differently, that's all.
Yes, you know, if we can just simply for the sake of it go into the theory part, you know, Swami is saying that to get the ultimate experience of self-realization, you need to have perfect faith. And many times Swami has said that there can be no faith without love. And love is possibly something that we can work more easily at developing, and that's why Swami kept, you know, encouraging us to develop in love, grow broader in love. And Swami would say you should have expansion love, not contraction love. In fact, it just reminded me of an episode of one of my classmates. He had the opportunity of serving Swami from close quarters. His name is Harish, and he was narrating how one day, you know, he was thinking of all the thoughts that go on in his mind regarding Swami and everything else. And he was also thinking of the privilege that he had been given to serve Swami from such close quarters. So one day he just told Swami that, "Swami, you know, I just have a confession to make. I don't think, Swami, that I have faith in you." You know, knowing him as a classmate and friend, you know, I can definitely say that he is not a non-devotee. He's definitely devoted to Swami. He has great love for Swami. And when he's saying that, "Swami, I don't think I have faith in you," it is possibly the higher kind of faith that Swami is speaking about here, and not the way we use faith in day-to-day parlance. You know, when I say I have faith in Swami, I believe that he is God, yeah, it's more like a belief rather than faith, because Swami's definition of faith is equanimity.
Right.
So he told Swami, he said, "Swami, I don't think I have faith in you. And you or me may misunderstand, you know, that question, but Swami knows what is going on within each person." And Swami's response was so beautiful. Swami said, "Do you love me?" He said, "Yes, Swami, I love you, but I don't think I have faith." You know, when you were narrating Mayur Pandya sir's experience about, "Do you love me?" I was reminded of this. So Swami said, "Do you love me?" He said, "Yes, Swami, I love you, but I don't think I have faith." Swami said, "If you have love, that's enough for me. You need not have faith." It's almost as if that once you love and once you're true in your love, faith will automatically come. Faith automatically comes. You know, that is the reason why we have faith in our loved ones. You know, be it our parents, our spouse, our children, our friends, whomever we have, to whatever extent that love, that much faith and trust we have in them. Because you, as Swami says, you cannot have faith and trust without love. Love is the prerequisite. It is the foundation on which faith is built. Since faith is possibly tougher to develop, Swami helps us to choose the path of love. That is probably why I feel that Swami brought in this element of bhakti into the whole movement, because bhakti is easier to develop. It's more enjoyable in that sense, and therefore, and it's also a most important prerequisite for faith to come in, and faith is a prerequisite for this ultimate experience to come in. It's also beautifully connected, though it sounds theoretical, it is so beautiful and interwoven, and yeah, I think it's done in a manner which only Swami can do it in.
And Swami is clearly saying that you know, that full faith is reached by sadhana. Swami is saying faith is based on love, but the full faith can be reached by sadhana, which means that with that love as the fuel, the sadhana has to be done, and that will lead to faith. And so Swami beautifully says that is like reaching Bangalore, reaching Bombay by approaching it. And I think it also hints that this entire conversation is actually happening in Bombay, which is now Mumbai, because we will see that in the conversation as we progress. But dear listeners, for now, we'll take a short break. We'll come back. Don't go away, because there are some interesting interactions which are going to take place in this particular session itself. We're going to play for you a song which was released as part of Swami's birthday celebrations. It was the music beautifully arranged by one of Radio Sai members, Brother Anirudh, but in the voice of a legend. I'll leave it at that. We'll play for you the song. We'll come back after that.
प्यार की नगरी में सदा कुछ न चाहिए साईं हमें बस चाहिए एक प्यार तेरा अब कुछ न चाहिए साईं हमें बस चाहिए एक प्यार तेरा तेरे प्यार में ही मेरा
Welcome back, dear listeners. The conversation continues where we had left off. But before that, you know, we were also listening to that beautiful song. What a song it is. What lyrics, what voice, what feeling. I feel these songs get magic not simply because of the lyrics and the tunes, but because of the love and devotion that have poured forth through these songs onto Bhagwan, and the love of Bhagwan that has poured forth onto the devotees and especially the students, because they used to sing it often through these songs. It is that love that saturates and makes it so beautiful. It makes it so energizing. Yeah, love is the one.
Think of it. In 5 years of being a student, I think we ourselves would have sung the song at least 6-7 times. And you can imagine how many times Swami must have heard it.
Hmm.
Because as you were saying, you know, it's like how many times people would have got up from Swami and said, Swami, can I take a Pad Namaskar? You know, Swami, give me prasadam. Swami will not get bored with that, because it's different people asking in different contexts in different times. As you said, these are all songs through which we can converse with Swami, and that's why how many ever times it is sung in front of Swami, for Swami it is a different person expressing the same love, you know, in a different context from their point of view.
And in a sense, you know, this is how I feel even to this day we can experience Swami. Possibly, you know, some people may have memorabilia that Swami has given them. And holding that memorabilia, you can go back in time and say that, you know, this ring that I'm wearing, or this chain that I'm wearing, or this handkerchief that I'm holding was once held by the divine or once touched by the divine. And that way you can connect. But even such physical memorabilia, it is not possible for everyone to have, though everyone clamors to have something. This memorabilia, you know, every time we hear the strains of this song, you can be sure that these same tunes, these notes have gone through the divine ears thousands of times, and you are getting a part. So in that sense, at a subtler level, this is a memorabilia that all of us can enjoy, and I think that is the reason we all enjoy it. You know, there are possibly thousands of songs with better tunes and thousands of songs with much more powerful lyrics, but the magic of these songs lie in the fact that they have touched God and they have been touched by God, and nothing on the face of earth or in the universe can change that fact. That is why they are magical. With that, dear listeners, we'll continue with the conversation. Hislop says, Swami, sadhana as it is described seems wrong because it is a conscious effort aimed at getting a reward. It seems to me that sadhana is real only when it is spontaneous. That is, when one naturally loves God, then he cannot help but love God, and he cannot help but make enquiry. So this question comes in response to what Swami says, that as long as you know you're meditating, you're not meditating. As long as you think you have faith, you're not having faith. So he continues by saying, therefore, Swami, as long as I'm thinking that I'm doing sadhana, I'm doing a conscious effort to get some reward, it's not sadhana. Because if it has to be true sadhana, it has to be spontaneous. Just like when one naturally loves God. And Swami agrees to him. Swami says, it is as you say. But you have not experienced that spontaneous love of God. It is still just an idea. You have a conviction that love of God exists naturally in you. That conviction, you know, itself, that conviction itself is a result of many lives of spiritual practice.
I think it's a very, very important question that Swami has answered. Because it's a confusion. I think many young people who come to the Sai fold, Swami students, youth in the organization, always have this problem. Because on one hand, we emphasize the importance of having love for Swami. On the other hand, we emphasize the importance of sadhana, which appears a little mechanical at times. You know, whether you feel it or not, whether you have that emotion or not that day, you go and sing bhajans that day, you wake up in the morning and do the prayers. Because you talk of sadhana as something which is rigorous, which you don't give up no matter what the conditions are.
Mm.
But love is a very spontaneous thing. I mean, it's very natural. Some days you listen to the song and you'll be breaking down in tears. Some other day you'll just be humming it like a nice tune and just walking. We have different emotions on different days. But sadhana is something which should not be subject to emotions. It has to be done at a particular time or in a particular manner, however you feel. So many times as youngsters we see that, oh no, sadhana, I do not have any taste for that because it's mechanical.
And no, boring.
I have love for Swami, and with love I sing once in a while. That is enough sadhana. But Swami is making a very clear point. He says, he's concurring with what Hislop is saying. Swami is saying, yes, you know, sadhana has to be spontaneous. But even this thought that you're having today, that sadhana is not as good as love, which is spontaneous, and sadhana, which is backed by spontaneous love, is more than sadhana, which is done mechanically. Swami is saying that even this conclusion that you've come to because of many, many lifetimes of sadhana. That has given you this love that you are feeling in your heart today. It's a very important point that Swami is doing. In fact, many times, I don't exactly verbatim recall the connection, but something similar to the conversation that you mentioned about this boy telling Swami that I don't have faith. When someone asked Swami that, Swami, how do we develop love for Swami? And Swami said, no, you pray. You pray for so many things. Why don't you pray for this? Why don't you pray to Swami saying that, Swami, I want to love you? And very sweetly, Swami said, I will give. You know, you can imagine Swami saying that. You ask me, I will give. I will give you that love for God. So yes, that love for God, spontaneous love and that emotion and that is the supreme. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But to get there, you need this process of sadhana, which is very, very important. So Swami is saying that lifetimes of sadhana is what gives you that spontaneous love for God.
In one shot, Swami is making clear both the things. That one, you can't rubbish away sadhana, and just because you're doing something in a disciplined manner continuously, you can't say that's the end all, because as we had discussed the previous week, the previous satsang on this theme, as you read in the beginning of this satsang, Swami says that the fence of discipline is needed, but the waters of love are also needed.
Right.
One without the other will destroy the plant. If there's no fence, then stray animals will eat away the plant. If there's no water, the plant can't grow at all. The fence is useless without the plant. That's how it is. You know, the plant is endangered without the fence. Without the fence of discipline and sadhana, our spiritual growth gets endangered. But without that love, that fence is meaningless. That's what Swami is so beautifully saying. Because we have to remember that in the ultimate object, analysis, it's all for that self-realization, to get that ultimate faith. And once again, I'm stating it where Swami says, faith means to be equanimous in the state of ups and downs. Recently, I watched a Marathi movie on the life of Saint Tukaram.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, you know, Tukaram's wife, who doesn't understand actually why her husband is so devoted to what she calls as the black idol. The black idol is the idol of Lord Vithala, with his hands on his hips like that. So she comes to him. She has great love for her husband. She loves her husband, but she just doesn't understand his whims and fancies. And you can understand how much she loves him by simply the fact that in spite of all his whims and whatever he's doing, she's still, you know, serving him, staying by his side, not the traditional way in which his wife is shown or spoken about, saying that she was very cruel. It is not cruel. She was like a normal woman, not able to understand. Like Swami says, there are God-mad people and the world-mad people. For the worldly-mad people, the godly-mad appear mad. For the godly-mad people, the worldly-mad appear mad. So that was the case there. So one day she asks him, you tell me, you were doing this business. He was like a moneylender. That is the profession he'll belong to. She says that you were a moneylender, you had so much money, you had all that, and you lost all that. Then you tried farming and now you have lost that. And then you lost people in your family. How many of, I mean, you know, it is actually after Tukaram starts, you know, realizing that life is meant for the divine and starts worshipping, that people start dying off from his family, you know, they start dying. So she asks, for all this, you believe that you're that black God has only done? You know, you say that black God is all powerful, he does everything. So this also he has done? And Tukaram says, yes, absolutely, he has only done all this. Then she says, then why on earth do you still go behind him? You know, he has brought only bad luck to you. And then immediately Tukaram says, listen, you came from such a wealthy family. You know, your feet have never touched the ground. Now you're walking on bare earth. Okay, she goes on talking of all the comfort she had, and he says, now you're, after getting married to me, all this you have suffered. Why do you still come and give me food? Why don't you just leave me and go? And she says, I can't, I'm married to you, I'm wedded to you, that's why. He says, that is what it is. I'm wedded to my Lord. See, this is what it is. No reason for, when Swami says no reason for love, no season for love, we enjoy it and get enthralled by it because we think of it only from our perspective that, irrespective of what I do, Swami should love me. But love is a two-way thing, you know, which means that irrespective of what Swami does, I have to love Swami. Can I do that? I mean, I always look at it like, even if I'm bad, even if I do dirty things, no problem. Even if I do wrong things, no problem. Because Swami's love for me is unconditional. But for me to experience that, my love for Him should be unconditional, which means, irrespective of what He does, I should still love Him. That is where that sadhana comes, that our effort also comes. You know, Swami always says, take one step towards me, I'll take 100. Why didn't Swami say, you sit there, I'll take 90 steps and come? I mean, Swami, don't take 100, just take 90. No, you have to put in that first step. You take one, I'll take 100. You know, different people say different things. Some says you take one, I'll take 10. Some says you take one, I'll take 100. The second part, you know, how much God takes, people have varied. I've heard people saying 1,000, 100 and 10. But you know what? Irrespective of what they say for how many steps God will take, everybody talks about you take one step. Which means me taking that one step is so important. That is why I can't even do away with sadhana saying that I just love God. Both are necessary. And I'm just speaking out long for so long because that is our job on afternoon satsang. But Swami has so succinctly put it. He has said, sadhana and discipline, that is a fence. Love is the water. You decide. You know, both are necessary for the plant to grow properly.
And the other interesting point which comes out in this is, you know, the first question which Hislop asked was about self-realization. The discussion here is about faith and love. The answer which Swami is giving for both is the same. You know, even there Swami said, yes, sadhana is required for you to understand who you already are. And here Swami is again talking about faith and love. He's saying that you already have that. You need sadhana to uncover that. So suggesting that, you know, it's the same whether you have complete jnana when you call it self-realization or atmic consciousness or, you know, brahmagnan or whatever it is, or you call it perfect love, the love which sublimates the ego completely, or perfect faith, all of that is the same. And it is suggesting that you already have it. And there's another philosopher who says this. He said, you know, he gives a very beautiful example. He says, what do you have to do to be able to see? He said, I'm sitting here, I'm able to see you. I don't have to do anything to see you. He said, because there is sight in the eye already. There's nothing I need to do to be able to see. Only thing is that if there's something obstructing my sight, if there's something between you and me, I have to remove that to be able to see. So the eye does not have to do anything to be able to see because that's its nature. That's what it is. So he puts it like this. He says, the heart always loves. Only something is obstructing it, and all that we do is trying to remove that obstruction.
Kama, krodha, lobha,
right,
moha.
Exactly. And Swami would call it the six inner enemies. So all the sadhana that you do is not to become more loving, not to learn how to love or learn how to have faith, but to unlearn some things which are not our part, or remove some things which are not essentially part of us.
At this point in time, another visitor, you know, possibly thinking that, wow, Hislop is getting all his answers, let me also get mine. So he says, what is the correct sadhana for retired people? And definitely he must be retired. I don't think otherwise anybody will ask. I don't think of a youngster. I can never, means, you know, in whatever few interactions I have had with Swami, means as a group, one thing I've noticed clearly is when anybody asks, gets the opportunity to ask Swami a question, it is something that is bothering them. Absolute selfishness comes to the fore in the presence of absolute selflessness. That's what happens, you know. I'll never ask any question that is possibly, you know, that person, it was bothering him, let me ask on his behalf. Never. And in a sense, I think that's also true because going back to that shloka where Shirdi Baba speaks about pariprashna. Pariprashna is that question for which you have that yearning, burning desire to know the answer. And such kind of burning desire and yearning to know the answer cannot come from others' questions. It can come from only a question that is bothering you, which comes out from you. So therefore, you know, that was a thought that just came. So this visitor must definitely have been a retired person. So he asks, Swami, what is the correct sadhana for retired people? And Swami promptly gives an answer. Swami says, meditation morning and evening and spend the day in good work. Good work throughout the day, morning and evening meditation. And then another visitor asks, Swami, what is the sadhana appropriate to ladies? I won't be surprised if that person was a lady. And Swami says,
Or a husband who wants to advise.
Advise his wife at home. Right. So, Swami says, ladies have the duty of house, children and husband. They are very busy. Meditation morning and evening can be done. During the day, all work that previously was done for others should now be done as worship for God. That is the best sadhana for ladies.
I mean, brilliant. I mean, that's probably what Swami has explained in length in one entire chapter in Dharmavahini, where I think masculine and feminine dharma or something like that, there's one topic.
Hmm.
And Swami speaks about what is the dharma of a woman in the household, of a man in the household. The entire thing given in such a crisp manner and so very succinctly put. You know, whatever work the woman of the house was doing already, she now starts doing it as worship. And that itself is best sadhana. Oftentimes, you know, you think of this. Swami is never a person who said that women should not work. Swami never is a person who said that women should not take up roles of something like our primary school school is filled with women like that.
In fact, in the, this Ladies' Day discourse, Swami clearly said that if you tell a woman not to work because of you thinking she's inferior or she's not capable, that is so wrong. You means everyone has to realize that when a woman chooses to take care of children, she's giving up a lesser task for a much higher task. In our mind, we take it for granted that children will be reared. No, to build children as pillars of character, to build them as pillars on which society will rest, as citizens of our country, of our nation, as the upholders of dharma, it is a huge task. And I have personally heard Swami on at least two occasions saying that it's a task that is humongous compared to earning a few rupees and coming. So therefore, we have to salute those women who consciously make the choice of giving up earning these material wealth so that they can concentrate and focus on building this. But if the need arises and the woman has to work, Swami says that anybody who discourages or puts them down are greatest fools. That was what the entire Ladies' Day discourse this year was also about.
The point that Swami is making here, especially in the context of sadhana, Swami is saying that, you know, yeah, you can take up something. Like suppose you say that, oh, I want to come and work in the ashram. I want to become a teacher here and do that. Oftentimes you can go and ask Swami, Swami, I want to do this meditation. I want to do this Kundalini Yoga. Swami will tell, if you want, you can do, but actually you don't need anything more than Namasmarana for Kali Yuga. You know, It is like over and above that, if you want to just do something to keep yourself occupied in noble tasks, you can do that. So similarly, Swami is saying, if you ask about sadhana for a woman, there's nothing more required. But that doesn't stop you from doing other things. If your interest is there in other things, if you want to work in the corporate world, and if you think that that way you're contributing to society more, that's well and good. But the basic minimum, what is required for sadhana, for self-realization, being born a woman, is nothing more than doing one's duty as worship. That is enough. That is the basis of what Swami is saying here.
It's like the need and want. I mean, this is what you need. If you want to do something more, definitely do. But I think it's also a statement of caution that in the quest of want, don't neglect and forget your needs.
Right.
Yeah. Over and above your needs, if you are fulfilling the want, there's no problem in that. But just ensure that this basic minimum, that need is met. On that note, dear listeners, we'll take another quick little break. On the other side of the break, we will continue with this discussion, which I think this interview, particular interview, comes to an end with this, because a new theme begins in the next conversation. Either way, it's definitely a new theme, so we'll take that up after the break.
Be
Seems such a horrible thing to speak after a beautiful song like that. You know, you should probably end with a music like that. It's so very soulful. But, you know, talking about what we were discussing in this particular episode, starting with self-realization, and Swami spoke about faith, Swami spoke about meditation. Meditation, of course, was dealt with very deeply in the previous episode. This song which we played, Pibare Ramarasam, is supposed to be written by a great jnani called Sadashiva Brahmendra. And if you read about his history, he's supposed to be someone who's so lost in the Supreme Consciousness. He is not spoken of as a devotee. He is spoken of as someone who is in trance most of the time. He is known as a person who is walking around naked most of the time. There are the episodes, if you read in his life, once he was washed away by the Kaveri when he was meditating on the banks, and many weeks later when they were digging somewhere, they found him under it, and he just got up and walked away. He was in such deep meditation. And such a jnani has written a song, Pibare Rama Rasam. He says, drink the
essence juice of the name of Lord Rama.
And he says, everything will be taken care of. All the sins will be washed away. I mean, and we sit here in debate as to which is higher, jnana or prema or, you know, karma. It's all one. The one who is there on right on top, he sees no difference. It's only we who are in the base of the hill find one to be a valley and one to be a hillock.
Absolutely. And continuing with the conversation, I mean, the conversation on the conversation, this is like a fresh conversation, it seems, because Hislop says to Swami, this morning in the taxi from the airport, even the driver had marvelous experiences of Swami's leelas. And the Bombay airport officers, they told other miraculous stories about happenings in their homes. So it's evident that Hislop has just come to Swami's presence after a travel. Possibly he has landed and he has come in the taxi, and so he's excited, thrilled at what all he has heard. Like, even the taxi drivers are speaking about Swami's glory, the airport authorities, everyone are speaking about Swami's leelas. And Swami responds saying, leelas are occurring throughout India in tens of millions of homes. Swami keeps his hand down so that publicity about the leelas will not spread. The rulers of the country know, but they keep it quiet. If the facts were to have publicity, millions would converge on Swami. I mean, so, that is the thing. And dear listeners, you can sympathize with us at Radio Sai or whoever has taken up the task of spreading Swami's glory. Swami himself, this is way back in
70s or 60s.
Swami is saying that it's happening throughout India, only India, in tens of millions of homes. So in millions of homes in India itself it's happening. Where then do we document and gather what's happening worldwide? His leelas can never adequately be covered. And Swami is saying that Swami has kept his hand down so that publicity about the leelas will not spread. This is amazing. And Swami also says, you know, the rulers of the country know. I was reminded of an episode where, you know, post-2011, post the Mahasamadhi of Bhagwan, a clean-shaven young man arrived at the studio and he was narrating about the Anna Hazare movement. And for those who aren't aware, Anna Hazare is a very, very respectable figure in India from the freedom struggle. He's quite old, I think. I don't know, must be in his early 90s or late 80s, definitely, from the freedom struggle. And he led actually a movement for transparency in the political system to bring about a corruption-free system. He definitely, with very noble and good intentions, he fought for it. At Jantar Mantar in Delhi, they sat in Dharna. And all this we got to know from the newspapers, definitely. But this lad happened to be one of the participants in that dharna. Dharna meaning non-violent protest, where you sit in a sit-in kind of protest. And at Jantar Mantar, they were all seated, and they were also jailed, I believe, for a few days. And this young lad too had been into the jail and all that. And it was very inspiring to listen to him talk about the, you know, the patriotism, the anti-corruption feeling that was coursing through the veins and arteries of all the youth in India. It felt good. It felt almost like the new generation that is growing up is sticking to a path of morality and ethics. So in that context, he was mentioning how he managed to even, you know, have a few interactions with Anna Hazare himself. And one thing that he mentioned was so amazing, because he said that Anna Hazare himself was asking all the different people assembled there about their background, because these were the crusaders in his crusade. So when it came to this lad, and he asked him where he came from, and this boy said that I am from Puttaparthi. And Anna Hazare apparently was so happy and his eyes lit up. And this boy asked him, Swami, he asked him, Annaji, do you know Puttaparthi, do you know Swami? What Anna Hazare ji said is so thrilling for all of us. He said that I am only an instrument of dharma. He is the embodiment of dharma. Of course, he said it in Hindi, but the translation goes like that, where he said, I am just an instrument of dharma. He is the embodiment of dharma. But, you know, if you go online and search for any articles on Anna Hazare or read his Wikipedia page, anything, you will not find any association of him with Bhagwan. This is what, you know, came in my mind when Swami is saying here that the rulers of the country know, but they keep it quiet. If the facts were to have publicity, millions will converge onto Swami. So that is the thing. And we should remember that just because some celebrity speaks about Swami, it doesn't raise Swami's status or level. And just because nobody is speaking of Swami, it doesn't. Swami is not bothered by this at all. It is only you and me with our minds that we evaluate Swami the way we evaluate anything. And therefore, if Swami's video goes viral, we get thrilled. And if Swami is not spoken about, we feel sad. But that is only concerning us and our minds, nothing to do with Swami.
And when Swami was saying this, it's happening in tens of millions of houses and only few recognize it from the point of view of an organization which is trying to document what Swami has done. Much of it is lost to us. And the thought which is coming to me is, you know, in a country, millions are happening, but very few is recognized. I think the same is the case with our own lives and homes. Swami must be performing miracles in that sense, leelas in millions. How many we recognize? I think that should be what bothers us more than, you know, did I get the vibhuti which came from that auntie's house, that auntie's calendar instead of that?
You know, speaking of we not recognizing a leela that happens, and also about vibhuti, you know, for a few days, you know, Prem, it was very amazing, thrilling, no doubt. Randomly, with no occasion, we used to have this vibhuti manifesting from Swami's photographs, and I fondly cherish those days. For some reason now, for the past few months, nothing of such, no such leela has happened. But those days, you know, this was immediately following Swami's Mahasamadhi, possibly as Swami's way of giving solace, it was like that. I remember that I would be in office or in the mandir or somewhere, I'll get a call. It'll be from my dad, and when I pick it up, he'll tell, Arvind, Vibhuti has come, you know, with so much excitement, and I would be so eager, like waiting to finish my work or whatever, get back home so that I can enjoy this leela of Bhagwan. And one day it so happened that I got a call, and my father said that Vibhuti has come, and I said, wow, wow, wow. And he said, you know what, it's having a sweet taste. I ate a little bit, it's having a sweet taste. Now that thrilled me amazingly, you know. Actually, honestly speaking, whether normal Vibhuti manifests or sweet Vibhuti manifests, both are equally glorious and grand. But as I said, our human mind gets mixed up in the whole process, and therefore we evaluate. And therefore I feel that sweet Vibhuti emerging from the photo is somehow a grander and a more nice leela than just Vibhuti coming. So I was very, very thrilled and so eager. I rushed back home. Our practice was such that whenever Vibhuti manifests from a photograph, for a full 24 hours we leave it like that, so that everybody gets to have darshan, whatever, at home. The next day we will clear it and take it into a box. So when I went back home, I saw that there was no Vibhuti anywhere. I then shouted out to my dad. I said, Dad, where's the Vibhuti? He said, I asked him, why did you clear it so fast? He said, no, I didn't clear it. Then where is it? He said, in front of that photograph. He said that photograph. There was no Vibhuti in front of that photograph. I said, Dad, it's not there. You come and see. He came there. It was not there. And instantly, you know, my dad's face was overcome with emotion and devotion. He folded his hand and he was saying, ah, look at the leela of Bhagwan. I was like, where's the leela? It's not there. He said, no, it was there. It went. Look at that leela. And, you know, it was only later that I understood. But at that moment, I was so upset, I was so upset that I couldn't see that, I couldn't taste that sweet Vibhuti. And I said, Dad, what are you saying, leela? He's saying, no, Arvind, see, without us touching that, Vibhuti went off. That's the leela of Bhagwan. You know, today when you said that, we don't recognize. forget the subtle leelas, even gross leelas like this. We identify a leela as a leela only if something that benefits my body and mind. If it is something that is making my body and mind feel sad or feel bad, I don't consider it as a leela. As we spoke about it before also. Even gross leelas like this we miss out because it is not as per our liking. We recognize only those leelas that happen in front of our eyes in a grand manner and those which are to our liking. So, in that scenario, so much more work we have to do on ourselves so that we are aware of the leelas that are happening every moment in millions of quantities in our life.
Recently, one of our very, very senior faculty passed away, Mrs. Tiwari.
A professor, I think, in the maths department.
Maths department, one of the senior most.
Hmm.
In fact, three generations of her students are working in the department.
Oh.
Her students and that student's student and that student's student is the HOD now. Then you can imagine how senior she is. One of the most brilliant people you would find academically and one of the most noble also.
Hmm.
And they had a wonderful session remembering her and of course another professor, Professor C.J.M. Rao.
Hmm.
They had a session remembering both of them. They had students coming in and talking about them. And I recall one of the students was narrating an incident where one day she came to the department and she handed over her phone, which was an old phone, you know, not the smartphones which we have today, in the 90s. And she gave this phone and said, and she told Beta, it's not been working since morning, do something about it. And she gave it to one of the research scholars there. And the research scholar, the moment he looked at it, he realized that the phone had got switched off. It must have crashed or something. It got switched off. So he just powered it on.
Hmm.
And it came on and it was fine after that. And he gave it back to her in a minute. And the moment she received it, her face lit up. Just like how you said that, you know, if you see a miracle, if you see something, her face literally lit up. And she said, Swami's grace.
Hmm.
And this student who was narrating that episode, he said, no, where is Swami's grace? You know, you just had to press the power button. It had to come on. But actually, now he's saying that now when I look back, she was not simply saying that. She really felt that, you know, anything pleasant happening is Swami's grace. Anything that gives happiness is, you know, Swami making his presence felt.
Mm.
And she literally lived her life like that. You know, that is a mark of a true devotee. You know, anything that happens to your life, at least start with the happy occurrences. You know, what Swami was telling about bhakti is when you have complete equanimity, whatever up and down happens. But are we at least in that state where everything happy that happens reminds us of Swami and say that, oh, this is Swami's grace. And I think that is the first necessity for us to recognize all the miracles that is happening within our life. Forget about happening all around us. But as we were telling, that to be able to rejoice Swami in that manner also, I think we need to do that sadhana and eventually turn to Swami and say, Swami, permit me to love you in that manner and permit that hand of yours to lift so that, you know, we can recognize your hand in everything that happens around us.
On that note, dear listeners, we will come to a close of this session because the clock in our studios is showing 1:59, just a minute away from when we are supposed to end. As always, we offer this humbly at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. And once again, I request all our listeners, you can definitely share in your thoughts and your ideas and your feedback via email by writing to listener@radiosai.org. We will do our best to incorporate most of it into our discussion next week. So see you again next week to continue this discussion. As of now, enjoy this beautiful song. And on the other side of it, you can listen to Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.